Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. Coming up on the show, Wyoming loses 60% of its young talent in any given year. But one program is trying to convince young people to make a U-turn.
Governor Meade wants me to come back to Wyoming, and it makes them feel special.
Wyoming tourism officials are thrilled about a new UW degree.
That it really was about the business of the tourism economy and what the vision could be. And so we got very excited about it.
And to the world's extremely wealthy, the most desirable fur on the international market is Wyoming's soft spotted bobcat.
They may not have a car, but they may have a $50,000 coat.
Okay. Those stories and more are coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. Mountain West states like Montana, Colorado, and Utah are seeing unprecedented growth right now. In fact, Idaho is the fastest growing state in the nation. But that's not the case in Wyoming, where the population is shrinking. Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen explores why.
Elsa Frohlicker grew up in Cheyenne, Wyoming.
I think Wyoming has a very small town feel, which I adore. I love it.
But Frohlicker wants to see more of the world. So when she graduates from the University of Wyoming this May, she'll be going to grad school somewhere else.
It's between University of Puget Sound, which is in Tacoma, Washington, and University of New Mexico, which is in Albuquerque.
An estimated 60% of young people like Frohlicker take their degree and leave the state. Brandon Checkey is another student who plans on checking out. He's about to finish his master's in accounting and will move to Omaha, Nebraska. It will be the biggest city he's ever lived in.
I think the mystery of it all is actually what I'm more interested in.
That, and there's a job waiting for him with Union Pacific, the second largest railroad system in the country. Checkey got the position through a college job fair. He says the benefits first got his attention, but it was the amenities in Omaha that sealed the deal.
And they have a lot more stuff that just goes on. They have a theater in downtown Omaha, and I think they have like a world-famous zoo and aquarium.
Still, kids itching to leave their hometowns isn't unique to Wyoming, especially in other rural states. So what else is going on? Samuel Western is a Wyoming author and cultural critic. He says Wyoming's problem has everything to do with its resource economy and the boom and bust cycle.
Traditionally, Wyoming has been contra-cyclical. That means that when commodity prices are high, people come in, and when they're low, they leave.
But that's not unique to Wyoming either. Other states have faced that reality. He says what is unique to Wyoming is how it's dealt with that reality.
We've just kicked the can down the road.
On the other hand, he says states with similar economies have realized that people and their ideas are better than natural resources at bringing in wealth, and they've diversified. Wyoming, he says, is just starting to get that. Governor Matt Meade recently introduced an initiative mandating economic diversity.
The fact that we are talking about it, that it's in print, that means we have to have people come into the state right now in order for me to make it work, is a fairly novel concept.
So how do you get people to come back? One way is the state program Wyoming Grown. Haley McKee helped launch the program.
We knew that we needed to look at folks who were familiar with Wyoming and familiar with the Rocky Mountain region, love the outdoors.
One of their strategies in luring young Wyomingites back is flattery. A friend or a family member who still lives in the state nominates someone who's left. That person then gets a letter from the governor asking them to come home. McKee thinks that's a powerful tool.
Governor Meade wants me to come back to Wyoming, and it makes them feel special.
But even if they don't come back straight away, McKee counts on them coming home eventually, something Frohlicker is already planning.
I would love to come back to Wyoming ultimately and raise my family here and spend the rest of my life here, for sure.
But again, college grads coming back to their rural states or small hometowns isn't unique to Wyoming either. And to get people like Brandon Checkey to come back, the Cowboy State will have to do more.
I think we would have to have much more growth in Wyoming, or at least a more diversified economy.
And that's what the state is working on right now. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Maggie Mullen.
The University of Wyoming will be launching an outdoor recreation and tourism management degree this fall. It's been a 3-year effort, but those in the industry have wanted the degree for almost 20 years. But as Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck reports, everyone is happy now.
Tourism and recreation is the second leading industry in the state. So it was crazy to many that the state's only 4-year university wasn't interested in helping the industry develop young people who could potentially work the wide range of jobs the state has to offer. Then one day, Indy Burke, who at the time was the dean of the Hobbs School of Environment and Natural Resources, reached out to the director of the Wyoming Office of Tourism, Diane Schober.
And it was the first time ever that I had heard someone at the University of Wyoming talk about a tourism degree that was more than a natural resource conservation type of management degree, that it really was about the business of the tourism economy and what the vision could be. And so we got very excited about it.
Schober shared the information with those in the tourism field, and they were off and running.
The industry has weighed in all along the way, from early research to interviews to we think this needs to be shaped a little bit differently here. And the university has been really responsive to that in working through the academic side and the input from the industry.
Schober notes there are jobs in the hospitality industry, at ski areas, museums, and state parks, and that's just to name a few. The Hobbs School's Doug Wachup did early legwork and helped focus groups with business leaders. He was pleasantly surprised at the list of skills they asked for.
Communication skills, critical thinking skills, teamwork skills, ability to work in digital environments, things like that. They listed those out first, and then they began to talk about things, well, I need a marketing person, or I need someone with accounting skills, or I need guides, you know, those sorts of things.
The other thing the advisory group pushed for was developing people with entrepreneurial skills.
Folks that would actually begin to develop or build existing businesses, start new businesses, things like that.
Dan McCoy is in charge of the degree program. He says it'll be diverse and utilize a variety of programs across campus that involve such things as science, business, and the humanities, to name a few.
And the skills that we want that students to have coming from this degree is the ability to kind of adapt and change career paths and trajectories throughout their careers.
The degree will have 4 focus areas that will include business and hospitality management, outdoor recreation and leadership, as well as 2 more.
Cultural and international tourism, which is working with international visitors in a Western context, and then recreation resource management, a little bit more geared towards the ski area operations, guest ranches, dude ranches.
There is going to be a lot of classroom work, but Doug Wachup adds that hands-on is very important. Students will be encouraged to get internships, and a stronger real-world experience will also be part of the curriculum.
But we also designed a professional semester, which is a very focused, concentrated time in their senior year in which they'll actually be working in and around industry, around capstone projects and some other things like that.
Rick Howe of the Jackson Hole Chamber of Commerce says a degree program should develop high-quality employees who are ready to deal with the many challenges of a guest service industry.
Whether it's dealing with how staff interacts with people, whether you're dealing with conflict resolution, I mean, education is so key because what you're typically learning is the best ways to handle something.
Alex Klein is the vice president and general manager of the Grand Teton Lodge Company. He says the degree is very important, and he likes the mix of the curriculum, especially in an era where all businesses are becoming more complex. Klein also hopes this will keep Wyoming students at home and no longer lose them to other degree programs in other states.
You know, we are the second largest industry in Wyoming, and I think we want to be able to educate the future leaders of this industry right here in the state of Wyoming and not send them out of state to other colleges and universities, and I think have a question as to whether or not they're going to come back.
Cheyenne Little America General Manager Tony O'Brien agrees. He says it's sometimes difficult to hire people who know and love Wyoming. He thinks the UW program will take the industry to another level.
Not having a degree in tourism, it hurts us. We're trying to grab people from other colleges that are close by, and you know, maybe they know or don't know about Wyoming. But I think it'll be really important to find quality long-term management employees that can hopefully last a long time.
Program coordinator Dan McCoy says there's a lot of student interest in the program, and not only from Wyoming, but from throughout the nation. The program will begin offering classes in the fall. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
When we return, we'll hear about a new study that says some forests aren't growing back after wildfires in the region. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. The forests you see around you today may not be there tomorrow. A new study published in the journal Ecology Letters says fewer trees are growing back after recent wildfires in the region. Nate Hedgie of our Mountain West News Bureau tagged along with researchers in Montana to find out why.
I'm marching through a stand of blackened, towering pine trees with fire ecologist Philip Higuera.
Ooh, we can smell the charcoal here. You smell that?
I do, yeah.
He's a low-key guy with a trim beard and sporty sunglasses, but when I ask him whether the massive wildfire that raced across this mountain last summer was bad, he takes exception.
It was bad if your house got burned in it. It was bad if you were breathing a lot of smoke and it inconvenienced you, but for the forest itself...
He says it was natural and needed. For centuries, he says, wildfires have acted as a kind of reset button, killing big, old trees and allowing new ones to grow in their place. But today, fewer trees are growing back, and Higuera blames hotter and drier summers.
The more we turn up temperature and turn down precipitation, the harder it's going to be for trees.
Higuera co-authored a new study that looked at more than 1,000 burn sites spanning 3 decades across Colorado, Wyoming, Montana, and Idaho.
We'd go out to a region, we'd identify a large fire, and looked for seedlings.
Seedlings are baby trees, and Higuera says they're really sensitive to climate. They need a couple of mild, wet summers to grow into adult trees. But summers in the West are becoming hotter and drier. So when the researchers visited the most recent burn sites, they found fewer seedlings were surviving. In fact, in about 1/3 of those sites, they couldn't find any new seedlings.
Nothing.
Zeros.
Wow.
Yep.
And that has big repercussions, especially in forests surrounding cities like Salt Lake, Boise, or Denver. Higuera says it's those woods that are most affected because they're at a lower elevation, where it's even hotter and drier than up in the mountains. So when they burn, he says, they may not come back.
We're either going to have... grasses dominate or shrubs dominate, or another possibility, which we won't know, like we're living out this experiment as humans, is it could just be that these places take much longer for trees to regenerate.
And finding out what happens to these forests in the future is Kim Davis's job. She's also a fire ecologist, and she's not that optimistic.
I mean, we have to at some point accept that we have had this impact and things are going to change, and I don't know how helpful it is to be really upset about losing forests. It just seems kind of inevitable.
And so this also begs a question, which is probably going to be a pretty stupid question, but can you go in and say, okay, we're going to water these forests so we can make sure that the landscape essentially stays the same even though climate change is happening?
I don't think that's practical. So any kind of, trying to reforest or keep our ecosystems the way they are now under climate change is probably unrealistic in terms of budget, time, money constraints, except for in very specific areas.
So bottom line, that means the West may look different than it does now. We're talking more grassland and desert and fewer forests.
I mean, of course, it makes me sad to lose forests. Just as a person, I feel like we just innately like forests. But on the other hand, I feel like I've spent so much time thinking about and studying climate change that I'm kind of like, well, just getting really upset about it isn't going to do anything.
But there is a silver lining of sorts. Fire ecologists say fewer trees and forests could also mean fewer or at least less severe wildfires, and that means less smoke. So you may not have as many trees in your future, but at least you'll be able to breathe. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Nate Hedgie in Lolo, Montana.
Too many decisions about the West get made in Washington, D.C. At least, that's what the Secretary of the Interior thinks. Ryan Zinke plans to move thousands of the department's employees out west to manage water, public lands, and energy from there. We decided to take a look at how a seemingly dull, bureaucratic plan might affect our region in interesting ways. We talked to some people with a vested interest, starting in Wyoming. Maggie Mullen reports.
Joel Bausman is a rancher and county commissioner in western Wyoming. His county is 80% public land.
So any decision made by the federal agencies does have an impact.
Bausman says that's meant both good and bad things for his community, especially its economic base, which relies on energy, agriculture, and recreation. But Bausman adds, right now is an exciting time, with the Interior Department proposing changes that could mean more control in the hands of local government.
Because we've always had concerns with the top-down approach of the federal agencies, both BLM and Forest Service.
Bausman says he has always looked for ways to enhance the role of local government in the decision-making process for federal lands.
And it is very clear that the best decisions are always made by people working together at the local level.
Bausman says having more federal boots on the same ground as locals like him could do the trick. I'm Maggie Mullen in Wyoming.
And I'm Ray Ellen Bichelle. Joel Bausman may be optimistic, but over here in Colorado, Ann Castle has some questions.
Well, I only know what I've read.
Castle used to be deep in the Interior Department. From 2009 to 2014, she was the Assistant Secretary for Water and Science.
I don't know exactly what the plan is.
Actually, no one does. The plan is vague, and it's changed a few times already. But here's what Castle says she does know. All this reshuffling is probably a bad idea. For one, it's expensive.
The department has asked for upwards of $17 million just in its first year.
Then there's the fact that most people who work for the Interior Department, about 60% of them, are already out west.
So most of the people are on the land where they should be, working in the regions where their projects are playing out.
Not stuck in a DC vacuum. Finally, she says, it's downright distracting, which might sound like no big deal, until you think about what these pieces of the government actually do. Take the Bureau of Reclamation, which Castle used to oversee.
They're getting water to people, whether it's farmers or municipalities. That's their mission.
And Castle says that is no small task. They don't have time for all this hubbub. I'm Ray Ellen Bichelle in Colorado.
And I'm Judy Faze in Salt Lake City, where political leaders are actually welcoming that hubbub. Utah's long complained about federal control of western lands, but now the state wants the feds to move here.
It makes a lot of sense to be really close to your customer, and the West is the customer of federal lands.
Tom Adams leads Utah's Office of Outdoor Recreation. He's part of a team that's lobbying Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke to move the department's headquarters to Utah.
You're on the elevator with Secretary Zinke. What's your pitch?
Good to see you again, Secretary Zinke. We know you're looking at new places for your federal land manager's offices. We'd love to let you know more about Utah. We are the third best for education.
This pitch sounds a lot like the talking points the states use to attract companies like Adobe and Goldman Sachs. Both have hubs here.
We are the number one economy in the nation. We are the third best for education. And we house some of the most iconic landscapes in the world that you manage. And we can provide wonderful quality of life.
Adams says he thinks Utah has an edge over other states for the same reason that companies are moving here. Think powder skiing and hiking around Red Rock Arches. Utah and other states are still waiting to find out the Interior Department's final plans for the reorganization. And while they wait, they'll be angling for a piece of the action. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Judy Faze.
Coming up, we'll hear about efforts to diversify agriculture in the state. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. As a part of a sweeping bipartisan spending deal to keep the government's lights on, Congress quietly set up a new budget commission. Wyoming Senator Mike Enzi chairs the Senate Budget Committee, and as Matt Laszlo reports from Washington, he's been strangely excluded from the panel.
Senator Enzi's a numbers guy. He's an accountant by trade, and he knows the budget process better than most anyone on Capitol Hill. But he voted against the deal to keep the government funded earlier this year, in which Democrats demanded hikes in domestic spending in exchange for GOP demands to increase the military budget. Even Enzi has heard the rumors he was excluded from the Budget Commission because he opposed the spending deal.
I'll leave that speculation up to everybody else, but I've been told a number of things.
But you would have wanted to be on it. You're the budget chairman.
Yes, and had been working on that diligently.
As the budget wonky is, Enzi has already spent more than 2 years working on ways to streamline the way the government budgets. He's held 13 bipartisan hearings on it and already has concrete proposals in hand to overhaul the way the government doles out or saves your taxpayer dollars. That's why Enzi wishes he weren't locked out of this new budget commission.
I would have felt a little more comfortable, of course, if I were the chairman of it.
Texas Republican Congressman Pete Sessions is on the commission, along with the chair of the House Budget Committee. When asked whether he was given an explanation as to why the Senate budget chairman isn't on a budget reform commission, Sessions brushed aside the question.
No, I don't get into that.
Missouri Republican Roy Blunt is a part of the Senate leadership team, and he's on the panel. He says he doesn't know why Enzi wasn't tapped to serve alongside him.
I certainly may have other obligations. I'm not sure. I've told him I certainly need his help and advice on that because he knows more about this than anybody else from a budget perspective.
Georgia Republican Senator David Perdue is also on the panel. And like Blunt, he says he'll be asking Enzi for input, even if Enzi won't be in the room.
Well, look, he's been an integral part of calling for reform. He's going to continue to be, an integral part in whatever we do. I can't speak to who's on the committee and who's not, but I just know this. I know his heart. He wants to get this fixed.
But Enzi's exclusion from the Special Budget Commission has set up a weird dynamic because he's promising to plow ahead and to keep looking for ways to change the budget process from within his committee.
There's not a good record for select committees. There's a much better record for things that go through actual committees. And I'll spend the year doing a lot of oversight and looking at some of the budget process in committee.
Enzi recognizes that with Republicans in control of Capitol Hill and the White House, there's a window to overhaul how the government doles out trillions of dollars each year. So as he moves forward on his own proposals, he's also going to be feeding the Special Commission his own ideas, like moving to a two-year budgeting process like they do in states like Wyoming.
There's no limit to what I can get done anyway. And actually, I know most of the people on the commission, so I will try to make it succeed.
The Special Budget Commission has until the end of November to try and reach a bipartisan budget deal. While for Enzi, there's no time limit on what his full committee can propose and pass. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Sustainability has become a buzzword when it comes to facing environmental challenges, but one researcher believes resilience is a better answer. For University of Wyoming Dean Mindy Benson, that means solving issues like pollution control, clean air, and acid rain with a more systematic approach that allows humans and nature to work together. She co-authored a book entitled The End of Sustainability about this new perspective. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim speaks with Dean Benson to learn more.
Let's start by talking about the core of your book, The End of Sustainability.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the core of the book is we're at a point right now where we have an opportunity to sort of rethink how we've been approaching environmental challenges. And one major way in which we've approached it in the past is based on a notion of separation, a notion that somehow humans are separate from nature. And so a lot of our environmental laws and policies have embedded within it what we call that nature-society binary. There's potential for a new approach that actually re-examines that and looks at the fact that there are no human relationships outside of natural relationships. And increasingly, there are no natural systems that don't have some type of human influence.
In your book's title, The End of Sustainability, you talk about how sustainability is kind of an outdated concept with this separation. And you highlight resilience as an alternative way to look at challenges. Can you talk more about that?
Resilience is a concept that means a lot of different things in different contexts. The way I'm using it here is in a way that invokes what we call systems theory, looking at both social and ecological processes as complex and dynamic systems that are interconnected, dynamic, ongoing change. Using resilience thinking is helpful in thinking about environmental challenges because it embraces the complexity of those challenges rather than trying to sort of narrow them down into like one type of concern or another. So for example, most of our environmental laws tend to focus on one type of problem at a time: air, water, species. A systems approach looks at the interlocking dynamics of all of those challenges and also recognizes that, you know, attempts to try and solve one problem can help create another problem in a different context.
Can you give an example of how resilience could be applied to a current policy and what that would look like?
Yeah, so a resilience perspective would really begin with trying to understand the system dynamics. What are the interactions that are happening? What are the different sort of major interlocking parts? And then backing out from there, there would be an opportunity to look at creative and innovative ways to take on solutions to those challenges. Rather than sort of identifying and sort of trying to isolate one problem at a time, you know, a resilience perspective instead tries to look at, understand the dynamics, and then kind of bring new thinking to ways of building the adaptive capacity needed within the system, rather than assuming that there's a problem to be solved.
So it would be companies as well that would embrace these techniques, right? Who could find system-based solutions?
Absolutely. And in fact, within the context of environmental law specifically, that's often what industry is asking for. You know, so they often will say, don't tell us what to do, tell us what you need, and let us figure out how to get there. And to some extent, we've done that with certain elements of environmental protection. So one example would be cap and trade initiatives with regard to acid rain pollution in the Northeast. You know, we used to have a really big problem associated with sulfur dioxide causing tree die-off and other types of concerns. And instead of coming up with a set, here's what needs to happen, there was instead put in place a system where industry could themselves identify the best and most efficient way to reduce that pollution. So in this case, the Environmental Protection Agency said, okay, well, here's the goal. We need to reduce the amount of sulfur dioxide coming out of this part of the country in order to maintain healthy lakes, healthy, you know, forests and that kind of thing. This is the reduction that we need to see. And then innovations came from industry as to how to meet that goal and how to make that possible.
What's one takeaway that you'd want readers to have from your book?
I think if there's one takeaway from the book, is that past approaches to taking on environmental challenges have been about division. And the future of taking on environmental challenges is going to be about connection. To the extent to which we see ourselves as separate from and apart from nature and as some outside force doing things to nature, that assumption puts us in a position where we fail to acknowledge how connected we are to the natural world. And from that place of connection, I think we can come and do much more creative, thoughtful, meaningful, and collaborative ways of being.
That makes sense. Well, I think that's a good point to end on. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
In 2015, Wyoming was the first state in the nation to pass a law allowing people to sell homemade food directly to consumers. The state legislature expanded the Food Freedom Act in 2017, and libertarians as well as food system activists have called it a win. But food safety regulations are still an obstacle for small producers who want to expand their businesses. Wyoming Public Radio's Alana Elder reports tackling that barrier has been one major theme in recent talks about diversifying agriculture in the state.
About 15 people are circled around a giant notepad at Casper College. They've already filled several pages and stuck them to the wall, and they're still brainstorming.
So, do we have any other big ideas for 20 years from now in agriculture?
Dina McDaniels of the Natrona County Farm Service Agency is leading a public discussion for agriculture and economic development enthusiasts. Three other groups like this one are spread across the top floor of the student union, and they're hoping to contribute recommendations to the economically needed diversity options for Wyoming or Endow Committee, As the group breaks for lunch, Agricultural Experiment Station Director John Tanaka tells me he's been pushing for one idea in particular.
I threw out this food innovation type center where it could be kind of a public-private partnership and do research and development for small businesses that really can't afford to have their own research and development divisions.
Tanaka's originally from Oregon and pretty familiar with a center that already exists in Portland. Researchers help business owners study things like taste, shelf life, and marketing. Powell Economic Partnership Director Christine Beckish is also interested in opening a food innovation center in Wyoming. She and some colleagues are planning to tour the Portland Center, and she's already visited one in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
One of the things I can tell you after my trip to Milwaukee was, wow, from a food manufacturing perspective, Wyoming is in an infant stage.
Most of the agricultural products that are grown or raised in Wyoming are processed in other states. Wyoming has hardly any food processing facilities, and that means that manufacturing money is lost to the state. People here are talking about the need for in-state factories and more slaughterhouses. Beckish thinks an innovation center could get things moving. She says producers could share expensive equipment or just get information that will make it less risky to try new things. She says it could also pick up the slack for small business owners who don't have time to experiment.
They put on their HR hat. They put on their sales hat. They put on their R&D hat. They're wearing so many hats, and oftentimes research might be the one that gets put to the side.
But Beckish is looking for big businesses to help her pay for a center in the Bighorn Basin. Many of the food innovation centers around the country are partnerships between food corporations and four-year universities. Beckish says she's gotten interest from at least one private partner, but no formal commitments. Jamie Purcell of Wyoming Food for Thought Project, an organization fighting hunger in Casper, is working on a variation of this idea, a food hub for distribution, marketing, and processing.
A place for people who don't necessarily have the means to build like their own commercial processing facility to come and utilize it and be able to innovate their raw product into something that is then inspected and able to be sold to businesses.
Purcell runs Casper's Farmers Market, and she works with several people who, under Wyoming's Food Freedom Act, can sell goods like jam, eggs, and salsa on a really small scale.
So you have a lot of micro producers in Casper, at least, who are making some really great foods, growing some really great things, but because they don't have access to a commercial processing facility, they're not able to scale up.
Stores and restaurants can't use these foods unless they've been processed following certain rules in commercial kitchens, which cost thousands of dollars to build. Purcell sees these shared facilities as a way to make local food available in every neighborhood.
So you have people working in your community, going to shop at little corner grocery stores, buying locally made products. So all of this money just stays in your community and continues to cycle around and around.
Not everyone is focused on moving agriculture toward a hyper-local future. At the Endow Forum, people spent just as much time discussing how to market livestock internationally and how to recruit young farmers and ranchers, as well as suggesting commodities that may be promising, like hemp, hops, and goats. These participants are excited about the opportunities in Wyoming. Some ideas will take money, and others legislation to become realities. For now, the public has shared a list of ideas with members of the Endow Committee, who plan to give recommendations to the governor in August. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Alana Elder.
Ahead, we'll wrap up the show with a story about bobcats and their furs. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. There was once a time when fur coats were highly prized. Here's actress Mae West.
You gotta get up early in the morning to catch a fox, but you gotta stay up late at night to get a mink.
You might think those days are over, but for much of the world's very wealthy, it's not. And the most coveted of all is bobcat fur from the American West. But some say they're more valuable alive. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards visited a Wyoming trapper to find out more.
Riverton trapper Tom Krause shows me around his workshop where furs of every sort are displayed on the wall.
I have some Pelser that...
Yeah, what do you have here?
To begin, I have a melanistic phase of raccoon, which is a black raccoon.
Ermine, wolverine, lynx. He has furs from all over the world. Krause has been trapping since he was 13. In his 30s, he even made a living as a trapper, and it's always supplemented his income. Finally, we come to the bobcat.
So this animal here is well spotted throughout the whole body.
Yeah.
And has a broad, deep belly. So this is one of the more valuable bobcats.
This winter, Krause trapped 13 bobcats.
I had some pretty nice bobcat pelts this year, and my average price on that was $400. So.
13 pelts at $400 a pop. That means Krause made $5,300 this year on bobcat pelts. Meanwhile, a beaver pelt only goes for $8. Coyotes, maybe 50. He says sometimes fur buyers even pay as much as $1,000 for an extra special bobcat pelt. It's the only spotted feline that's still legal to trap in the world. And Wyoming's bobcats are soft as a bunny, while those in other places are wiry and stiff. It takes about 30 bobcat bellies to make a coat. Krause shows me one he had made for his wife.
When I had this made, it was appraised at $3,500. Today, it would be worth more, maybe twice that much.
Internationally, bobcat coats can sell for $100,000 to extremely wealthy Europeans, Chinese, Russians.
If people have a lot of money, want to really be flashy and show their money, a bobcat belly garment is attractive and valuable to some of those people.
A recent study, though, says that Wyoming could be making much more on bobcats by leaving them alive. Lisa Robertson is the president of Wyoming Untrapped. She came up with the idea for putting a dollar value on live animals while watching a wild bobcat on the Madison River near Jackson.
There was a BBC photographer there as well, and he had been there for 2 weeks photographing. And we sort of worked together, finding the bobcat, watching it, and we realized this is a very valuable bobcat.
Many tourists made special trips to Wyoming to photograph the Madison River bobcat that winter. So Robertson started reaching out to wildlife watchers to see how much they'd spent in Wyoming on such trips. On hotel stays, restaurants, gas money.
The number we came up with this bobcat for just those 3 months, for just those people we contacted, was $308,105. And in a market where tourism is the second largest industry in Wyoming and generates $3.2 billion a year, that's a remarkable number for one single animal.
$308,000 for one bobcat. Comparatively, Robertson found that a trapper making a trip to kill one animal only brought in $300 for the state's economy. And Robertson says trapping them is also inhumane. To preserve their pelts, bobcats are choked to death rather than killed with a quicker gunshot. And in Wyoming, trappers only have to check their traps every 3 days.
When there are cold temperatures and it's minus 10 degrees, minus 20, you know, that bobcat cannot feel its paw. There's a good chance it's going to bite that foot off or rip it off.
Robertson would like to see Wyoming require trappers to check every 24 hours instead. And Robertson says with the value of bobcat pelts so high, Wyoming Game and Fish Department needs to set a limit on how many bobcats can be taken a year. 10 years ago, over 3,000 bobcats were trapped, but last year it was only 1,400, half as many.
I think there are more trappers in recent years, and they're catching actually less bobcat, which means to me that there just aren't as many bobcats out there.
Yet a 2010 Fish and Wildlife Management study shows that bobcat numbers are actually increasing in most states.
Wyoming has some great bobcat habitat and associated bobcat numbers.
That's Wyoming Game and Fish Department Deputy Chief Scott Edberg. He says bobcats are doing fine in Wyoming. They're very elusive, and he thinks trapping permits are the only way to keep track of population numbers. But he says they still reevaluate the bobcat season every few years.
We're always looking at if there's something out there that needs to be tweaked or changed, but we feel that the current statutes and regs are working.
Out in his garage, trapper Tom Krause is demonstrating how a number 2 foothold trap works.
So this trap will be staked solidly in the ground and then covered with dirt. But I'll go ahead and spring this trap now.
Krauss wrote a handbook on how to safely and more humanely trap, including following regulations very carefully.
I think it's really good, too, that we do harvest and pursue some wildlife because it keeps them wild and they get smarter and the genetics are passed on.
Wildlife advocates aren't convinced. They say the international fur market is affecting North American wildlife and recently filed suit against the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Another hearing is set for later this month. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
The new play, The Big Heartless, premieres in Laramie this week. In it, playwright Dale Dunn explores the subjects of wolf reintroduction and reform boarding schools. She told me she initially became interested in the fate of wolves after an experience driving on a highway outside Santa Fe.
I was on a road trip with a friend of mine, and we were actually coming home from the road trip. We'd been up in northern New Mexico exploring a little bit. And we were coming into Santa Fe, and it was just starting to get dark, and everybody was starting to turn their headlights on. I turned mine on, and these yellow eyes got caught in the headlights. And at first I thought, is that running across the road? No, it's running straight at me. And as I get closer, I think, it's dogs. It's two dogs running on the road. Oh my gosh, they're going to get hit. And as I get even closer to them, both my friend and I say at the exact same time, wolves. And there's two wolves running in the lane, in my lane, in the highway, straight at me. I start to slow down. There's traffic on the right, a divider on the left. There's no place I can go to avoid them. I'm easing up because there's traffic right behind me. Everybody's coming into town 60 miles an hour. I ease off on the accelerator, and I think, well, I can swerve a little to the left to try to give them room, but I can't swerve much because there's this concrete divider there. So I'm just holding on to the steering wheel, and they go right by me. I don't hit them. Nobody else slows down. Shoo, they're gone. And my friend and I look at each other, and we both say, did you see that? Yes, I saw that. Those were wolves, right? Yes, they were wolves. And the hair on the back of our neck stood up, and I don't know what happened to them. Nobody else slowed down. It just kept going. When we got home, I went on the internet to see what kind of wolf, what was that? And they were Mexican gray wolves. They looked just like when I pulled it up on the internet. And they had been traveling a lot on the highways, I read, because of there was a lot of snow. And when the snowpack gets deep and difficult to travel through, they take to the highways.
How do wolves come up in your play, The Big Heartless?
Well, after that experience, I started doing a lot of research about the wolf reintroduction programs that are going on in Montana and Idaho and in Yellowstone Park. And I discovered a story about a guy named Carter Niemeyer, who was used to be with Montana Fish and Wildlife. He was a trapper, and he trapped wolves for many years, and he killed a lot of wolves in his time. And he got to know so much about wolves that he went to the other side and started working with the Wolf Reintroduction Program in Yellowstone. He wrote a memoir called Wolfer, and through that book I heard about these two wolves that were one of the first pair to be brought into Yellowstone, number 10 and number 9. And they went through quite a horrifying story. They kept leaving the park because they kept trying to go back to Canada where they'd come from, which was very risky for them because they had to travel all the way through Montana. And there were a lot of angry ranchers and people looking out for those two wolves. So those two wolves are in my play, and their story is woven throughout the play.
Can you give a brief synopsis of The Big Heartless?
Well, it's the story of a guy who works with the Wolf Reintroduction Program, and he's a bit of a hermit. He's retired from the Fish and Wildlife and is working for the reintroduction program, and his name is Uncle Mac. He's surprised one night by the arrival of his nephew, Cliff, and his sidekick, Monsoon, who have escaped from a tough love reform school up in northern Montana and have come to Mac seeking solace. And what happens then? You'll have to come see the play.
What are some of the themes that emerge in this production?
One of the main themes I was working with was that, it's that fear is what makes the unknown horrifying and terrifying. If you don't know something, it's scarier than if you know about it. And another theme is that we as humans have a tendency to lock up or kill anything we don't understand or that we fear. So the two wolves and the two teenagers, their stories are sort of running parallel through the play. And it's all about trying to find your pack and where you fit in.
Why do you think theater and fiction are appropriate vehicles for teaching and discussing these real life issues of wolf reintroduction and reform boarding schools?
Well, theater, I think, is a wonderful format for discussion, and because it brings people together in a live space where we are sharing the actors inventing this story before you, and it makes you think in a new way because it's all happening right in front of you. It's not removed on a screen or even in a book. It's live in front of you, and some of the emotions that it elicits are quite surprising and wonderful. It's a magical thing, theater is.
What do you hope audiences take away after the end of the show?
I hope that they learn a little bit about the fate of wolves and teenagers, and also take away the feeling of that we have to take care of each other.
Dale Dunn is a playwright. Her show, The Big Heartless, runs through April 14th at the Griffin Theater in Laramie. Dale, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Caroline. It's nice to be with you.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. If you'd like to hear the entire program or individual segments, go to our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Anna Rader is our web editor. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.